Tobias Carlyle is the founder and principal of Acquires Funds. For regulatory reasons, we will not discuss any of the Acquires Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquires Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquiresfunds.com.
Hey, it's Tobias here. If you want to learn a little bit about my firm or see my portfolio, head on over to acquirersfunds.com. Preparing to live stream. Meeting is now streaming live on YouTube. All right, going to find out.
I think based on last episodes,
we are live
right now. So let's just go.
All right.
That's right.
Well, it's value after hours. It's 10:30 a.m. on the West Coast, which means 1:30 p.m. on the East Coast. I think that's how it works. UTC. Sorry, guys, I've lost the horizon there. Australia, it's like 3:30 a.m. Good luck to everybody figuring out what time we record this. What's happening, fellas?
I was thinking the other day that I'm mad about our time zone difference now because we can't do our Thursday night hangouts.
Yeah, you messed that one up, Bill.
I did. 3 hours is a big difference.
Yeah.
That's what's happening. You asked me. That's exactly what's happening.
JT, you might have to turn your mic up a little bit. You're a little bit quiet there. A little bit in the background.
What I was saying, dog.
Huh. I'll just try to talk louder then. How's
just
that?
Just get a little bit. Just shave with it.
I can't get any closer.
So what's happening, fellas? What are we talking about today?
Well, yeah, last week I picked on the 30% cash position, so this week I'm going to offer how to hedge it.
Ooh, I'm all ears for that.
Cyprus, what's up? What's good? I think you might be our first Cypriot. Welcome to the show. What about you, JT? You got some veggies prepared for us?
I do. I have
baby carrots.
Yeah, it might be a fun one. My kids are in homeschool this year, lamentably, but we did, where I live is about a half an hour drive from Coloma, which is where they found gold for the gold rush in California in 1848.
Wow.
So we did a little field trip last week up to Coloma to talk about the gold rush. And after I found some parallels that might be interesting for us to talk about. So I've got some good stories to share on that.
Well, that sounds good. It's Goob's asking what time it is. It's like 10:32 on the West Coast. You have to figure it out from there. What about you, BB? What do you got?
I just said what I was going to do.
It's hedging.
I'm gonna offer the hedge to the 30% cash.
All right. That sounds good.
Is that 60-40 Tesla Bitcoin? Is that the hedge?
Yes, it actually is something similar to this. Yes, that's exactly right.
I'm going to talk about, I think growth got crushed in Q1, but I think growth has had a nice little run for the last month, which means that value's been treading water a little bit. I don't know what it means. I just want to test the crew, test the audience, see where we're going from here. I want some predictions carved in stone, written in blood.
Glad to see those guys finally catching a break.
Isn't it good? You like to see that happen.
Yeah, warms the heart.
Now. Who wants to go first? Who wants to take the arrows?
I don't want to hear this hedge that Bill's got.
All right, let's do
that. Well, yeah, I just think that, first of all, I stole this from my man Alex, but I think he's right. So we were discussing like how, you know, if you are worried about valuations. So let's say that you're concerned about valuations to like being too high. There's a world where you can say, okay, well, I'll buy some puts. There's also a world that you can say, well, I'm going to hold some cash. But like, if you go to 30% cash, that's really kind of a market call. So his thought was you should buy like YOLO calls on the fastest running stuff to offset your cash hedge or cash position. And I actually kind of like that idea.
Yeah, I like that too. That was what we talked about this a little bit. I'm pretty sure we did this on the podcast, but one of the things that hedging the right tail, and if you're going to cash up, I think it was something that, what's his name? And it's just escaping me. The Google Rishi. It was Rishi's idea, right? Get some cash in Q1 2020.
Yeah.
And then buy the leaps. So if the market doesn't fall over and it rockets from where you are, you've already got a little bit of exposure, but you've kind of decided how much you're prepared to lose if it goes the other way.
Yeah. I kind of like that. It's a, like, I don't know. I think that there's instances in the market where I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. But I like that Adam Robinson, when he once said that things that make sense and things that don't make sense are where you should look, because a lot of the times, if you say something doesn't make sense, it's your version of the world that actually doesn't make sense. I like the idea of using a small portion to like hedge what I think is correct in the off chance that I'm not omniscient, which is obviously a false assumption, but I do like that. It's intriguing to me.
I mean, do you think that those are mispriced right tail insurance?
Calls? Yeah. Leaps? It would seem to me they're not in this sort of market.
I wouldn't think so either.
Yeah, but by definition, you don't think so if you're 30% in cash, right? And this is all a hedge on your own mind.
Like, it's kind of, but it's also the way you've also got to, you know, there is also this principle that you're trying to buy stuff that's undervalued, right? And so I try to be a little bit guided by that. So I think that the time to buy crash insurance is often, you know, when the market's ripping, like that crash insurance is cheapest at the tops.
I'm talking about upside insurance.
Yeah. I think it's a good idea. I do think it's a good idea because it does sort of force the humility. Like you're just saying, what if I'm wrong? That's literally all you're saying.
Yeah. And I know that it's kind of nuts. And I understand that, like, as a value person, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And I get that that's not what Buffett did. I'm just like, I'm not Buffett. And at the end of the day, like, if I underperform for 6 years, it's going to hurt me emotionally. So is that a way to hedge that risk and make myself more rational? Is just kind of like a fun theoretical discussion.
Isn't that why you invest emotionally?
What?
To get hurt emotionally. That's why you invest.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's a good point. Yes. It's a good pursuit for people that hate themselves.
I mean, it's kind of it's FOMO guardrails.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also, like, it is FOMO, but on the other hand, it's also like, there are things that happen that I don't know. There are paradigm shifts in the world that occur that are not just FOMO related. So I don't know. It's just,
but it is tough, right? So I look back at like 1996 is a big inflection point where previous to that time, the, you know, if you're using a cyclically adjusted PE, something like that, it had been trading sort of around 15 times, pretty, you know, it moved in big waves, but 15 times was the median. In 1996, which is coincidentally when Shiller publishes his paper on the Shiller PE, since that time, it's been consistently a long way north of 15. It's probably 20 or 22 for the last sort of 25 years, I guess. So that's a paradigm shift. I don't know if it's permanent, but like 25 years is getting pretty, that's a generation. That's pretty long. It's hard to see how we go back to a long run average Shiller PE of 15. And having said that, like, market gods, strike me down. Like, please show me how my lack of humility. Like, let's go back to a 15 world.
Yeah, to get back to a 15 mean over that's going to be a rough 25 years.
Well, you could just trade around it, right? Like, yeah, but you're right. It's going to be while we're losing the tail of this long period. Yeah, it's going to be cheap. But you, when you look back over the Shiller PE of a long, like, it has spent lots and lots of time under, like, I think the long run means now 16.6 or something like that. So it's spent roughly half the time below that level. It's kind of hard to believe.
Yeah. And the other thing that, like, I think is hard to believe is, even though, I mean, look, there's one world where you just say, well, it's all been multiple expansion, so this is all tenuous. But I don't know. I mean,
they're like, better businesses. Like Google's clearly at Google, Amazon, Microsoft at scale are clearly much better businesses than anything we've seen before, right? They've got very extremely high returns on invested capital at this level. Like basically they need no capital in those businesses. They could just be trading on infinite numbers. And then they've got gigantic margins and they're going to be difficult, if not impossible, to replace. And now they're a big chunk of the index too. So I can sort of see how you could get to an argument where you would expect a higher Shiller PE given the composition of the index.
Yeah, I think that's right, given the composition of the index. The other thing that like is really hard for me to sort of see where like where we talk about dispersion a lot, right? And I guess that part of I don't know whether or not it's mispriced, right? But like these big companies, they have a lot longer growth runways than a lot of the previous sort. I think that they can reinvest for a long time.
I mean,
and
it
they've
turns
demonstrated
out,
that.
Look at Amazon, like 48% on $100 billion. Like, what?
Yeah.
It's hard to and believe.
Yeah, and I mean, you're comping that against like, you know, I don't know, the U.S. real GDP growth from 2000 to 2009 was 1.8%, and from 2010 to 2019 was 2.3%, despite all those deficits. Like, there's just no growth there. So,
what's that like over the full history? Yeah, that's low growth. You're saying that's low growth.
Yeah, yeah, it's like almost nothing. It's anemic. So, I mean, what you've got, we'll start at 1940 just because whatever. I'm happy to go back a little further, but 40 to 49, 5.4%, 50 to 59, 4.3%, 60 to 69, 4.4%, 70 to 79, 3.3%, 80 to 89, 3.1, 90 to 99, 3.4, then 1.8, then 2.3. So it's like growth has just collapsed.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? Just the size of the, you just can't grow at those rates forever, or what's the reason?
Well, I guess some of it's probably that we've pulled forward a lot of the growth through debt and whatnot, I guess. I don't really.
But wouldn't you have seen that? Wouldn't that mean that you had high growth? Or you're saying that up until 2000?
I'm saying you've seen it, right? You've seen it from 70 to 2000 or 40, really 40 to 2000, right, is maybe what's gone on. But I honestly don't know. It's outside. This is getting too hard for me.
But then I
just think that, like, you know, your returns on capital matter, but your reinvestment rate does too, right? And like, if your economy is only growing 2%, you know, average, you're somewhat limited in what you can reinvest it. But these big tech companies are not, like, they're global, which helps,
right?
So the dispersion of them, like, I can understand why assets would be attracted to those businesses relative to the rest.
And it's a big difference between when, you know, the biggest company in the S&P 500 used to be Exxon. Like, that was 40% of the index, I think, at one stage. 40% is just insane for something as cyclical as that. Like, you can clearly see how that index is going to be a lot more choppy than the current one, which is, I think, that the biggest three or four are like 20% of the index. And they're all those tech companies that have got subscription style revenues and, you know, very wide moats.
Yeah. Now, somewhere there's a value investor screaming at their screen. So I will shout you out this. You know, you would think that with those low growth rates, presumably some overcapacity was built in the 90s. And some of that, like, this is kind of why I like some of these commodity ideas, even though I'm not going to touch them. But I do understand why people would say, well, the industry has been forced to get rational. So on the back end, you're going to have super normal profits, like through a capital cycle theory. Right. When you're going from people built in 99 thinking there was going to be a ton of growth. And then you've just had just like 20 years of just shit returns. I mean, commodities, I think on this same thing, Modest Proposal had this thread, but I'm pretty sure that commodities real returns have not been positive over any. Yeah. On the last 100 years, the CRB index was negative 1%. Last 75 years, like negative 1.7%. Last 50 years, negative 2%. So, I mean, like, they just... There's
is
been
that
no...
by virtue of where we are? Like, the, is that by virtue, is that the end date that creates that? You know, like the end
probably,
price?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, almost certainly.
Well, you're, if you're long commodities, you're short human creativity.
Yeah. And we've been getting better and better at pulling stuff out of the ground. Although, you know, when you look at oil, like it's we're increasingly heroic kind of efforts to pull it out. That's why you get those deep water, you know, the deep water disaster, because we to find it, it's a long way offshore, and then it's really, really deep, and it's like we're doing some special stuff to get it up. It's amazing that we're still able to do it.
Well, and then you got fracking, right? Which I think is a pretty heroic. You know, that was quite creative to be able to frack a well. Now, you know, people will say it relied on debt, and I'm not making an argument for whether or not it's economic, but like the engineering feat of fracking is pretty impressive.
Plenty of equity got ripped up in that too.
Yeah.
Shout out to those bros. Tip one out for the equity investors in the shale.
Yeah. So not a game I wouldn't want to be perpetually long oil. I wouldn't mind flipping the assets, but it's not a game that I would just be long.
But then you look at China, like just to sort of go back to where we were before, I was talking to Stig Broidison over the weekend, and he said that Pinduoduo is the fastest growing Chinese sort of listed company. I think he said from a standing start to where it is now is 3 years, and it's $155 billion market cap, I think. And it's just growing at 100% a year. 100% a year.
Yeah, that's nuts.
I say it's China's farmers only. It's not quite, but it's an interest. It's China's it's like the Groupon. It's China's Groupon, except they do it right.
So when you're looking at something like that that's growing 100% a year, like, I mean, you know, if you put a 50 times sales multiple on it and it drives 85% gross margins, like that's maybe not that crazy. To me, the question becomes, okay, well, if it's $150 billion market cap today, can it become a $600 billion market cap in, you know, 12 years or whatever?
I think you've almost got to throw out those sort of old, like whatever you think of as being the cap, or like whatever you think of as being a big company. Like that definition is always going to change over time for two reasons. One, because we're just pumping out a gigantic amount of money into the, you know, everything's being denominated in more and more dollars, so everything's going to go up on that basis. But also because these businesses, they've really got one interface with the customer, and so they can spend all their time working on that single interface, which means that everybody gets that white glove. You know, everybody's experience with Google is the same, for good or ill. It means that mistakes are worse.
Yeah.
Good topic. Whose topic was that? Was that yours, Bill?
That was me. I don't know if it's a good topic. It's just one that I've kind of been thinking about. You know, I've gotten less confident that I'm right over time. And it was just kind of a fun thing to bat around in my head. And again, it's Alex's idea, and we've talked about protecting to the downside, so it's not like novel, but it was just kind of something I was thinking about today.
You want to do the veggies, JT?
Absolutely.
You're a little bit quiet. We're getting consistent folks, so you might have to shout it.
People, don't worry. I told them this before it started. I'm on your side. I'm the man of the people. Well, Toby is too.
You have to subscribe to hear Jake's audio.
Yeah, we're putting Jake behind the paywall today.
Is that any better that I took my?
Yeah, mic much out? Better.
It's definitely louder.
All right, I think my mic's broken or something.
We're gonna put you on OnlyFans just for the day.
get that real money going.
Yeah, you sound much better now.
Okay, good. All right. So like I said, in the intro, this is the kind of gold rush edition of veggie segments. So let me start by painting a little picture for you. It's 4.5 billion years ago, and the Earth is in its early formation, and this heavy molten iron is sinking to the core from the gravity. And with it, it pulls along most of the planet's precious metals. So like gold and platinum. So it's estimated that there's enough precious metals in the core of the earth that if they were taken out and put on the surface, that it would be 4 meters deep around the earth. That's that much gold and platinum inside of the core.
That's about 12 feet.
Thank you for the conversion. Toby's like a farmer's almanac.
Well, I had to learn all that stuff. I had to translate because I think in feet and meters.
Do you think in meters still?
Yeah, mostly. Yards, huh. You know, same thing.
But they're not, though. They're slightly off.
Yeah, yards are a bit smaller. Meters make a lot more sense.
1,500 meters in a mile, right?
1,600.
Okay. I thought it was 1,650 yards. Anyway, my bad.
4 stadia.
Oh, snap.
Whoa.
How's that for veggies?
Yeah, that's deep cut there.
How many cubits is that?
So there's also some recent research to suggest that a cataclysmic meteor event that was roughly like 20 billion tons of asteroid hitting the Earth deposited most of the gold that's in the mantle of Earth. So it's when you think
about... Is the mantle the crust? What's the mantle?
It's like the in-between, the very outer crust and the like inner core.
I did not do geography or whatever this is, geology.
Yeah, geology. So, I mean, the idea that gold is formed inside of like a neutron star and then, you know, hitchhikes its way to the Earth is kind of its own like sort of amazing, you know, astronomical feat. But let's fast forward now, and it's 400 million years ago, and you're on the ocean floor and this volcano is erupting and it's spewing, you know, kind of the internal part of the earth out onto the ocean bed floor. And
that's very metal.
Yeah. These tectonic forces then thrust mountains up out of this ocean and we get an ice age. And it eventually rain is pounding these mountains and it's eroding the soil away. And it's causing these rivers that then carry little bits of yellow metal that were buried that came out of the middle of the earth and up in, you know, thrust from the oceans into the mountains. And it washes them and deposits them quietly into like river and stream beds. And so now let's fast forward and it's 1834. And this 31-year-old man, he flees Switzerland to run from his basically debtor's prison. And he leaves behind a wife and 5 kids, travels around all around America, eventually ends up in Honolulu for a while, and then finds his way back to Alta, California, which is at that time was actually a possession of Mexico. It was a territory of Mexico. Now, this man whose name was Johann, but then changed to John Sutter, he persuades the governor of that province to give him 48,000 acres in what is now today the Sacramento Valley. And he starts building a fort. And unfortunately, he's terribly abusive to the native population, enslaving them, basically treating them quite shabbily. But he has these dreams of creating this kind of agrarian utopia here in California.
Not for the natives.
Not for them, no. And to go back to like why I talked about the ocean, or like the mountains being thrust out, like, what we were zoomed in on was the Sierra Nevada mountains that California at one point was under in the ocean in a previous, you know, previous geological cycle. So that's where all the gold in the mountains came from, was, you know, through volcanoes at the bottom of the ocean that then got thrust up into become these mountains.
I think there's a lot of people who'd like to see it go back that way too.
Yeah. Back underwater. So 1848 and, California becomes a U.S. territory now. And now all of a sudden Sutter is in the U.S., but I mean, he was living in Mexico before. And he hires this guy named John Marshall to go build a lumber mill, a sawmill up about 40 miles upriver from where he was at Sutter's mill, which happens to be in this little town called Coloma, which I mentioned at the beginning is about 25 minutes from my house. So one morning, Marshall gets up to inspect the tail race, which is the like kind of the output part of the mill. And he finds these gold nuggets in there and he brings Sutter in and they look at it and they do some really rudimentary tests, like, you know, putting it in lye. And they realize, oh my God, this is gold.
Putting it in what?
Lye.
Like,
what's that?
It's like what people used to use to clean their clothes.
Okay.
It's like a very, very strongly basic solution.
Okay.
Good for getting rid of dead bodies too.
Yeah, apparently.
Thank you, Dexter.
So Sutter is really anxious about this gold because he doesn't want people to know about it. Not because he wants the gold, but because he wants to build this kind of agrarian utopia, and he's worried that it'll mess up his construction and farming plans. But like any good news like that, it gets out. And this man named Samuel Brennan, who he was actually the founder of the first San Francisco newspaper, he hears about it and he runs around through the streets yelling, "Gold, gold, found up the American River." And by the way, before he did that, he bought all the picks and axes and shovels and pans in the city. And he paid like 15 cents for a pan and then sold it for $15.
Yeah.
So he was like, you know, crying gold while he had all the supplies to give away. And he became California's first millionaire, by the way.
So the guy who sells picks and shovels to the gold miners is the first millionaire.
Yes.
That's great.
So that's like in March of 1848 is when they discovered gold. It isn't until August of that year that a newspaper in New York publishes a story about it. So, I mean, it took like 5 or 6 months to get from the West Coast to the East Coast. Now, once it gets published, like it's on now, like everybody in the world hears about it. And 300,000 people soon arrive in the area, and they're called 49ers because they came in 1849. And that's where the San Francisco 49ers football team came from.
That's how the Rams get their name. No, I'm just kidding. It's the 49ers.
Yeah. So at that time, there's this little sleepy village called Yerba Buena. And in 1848 or 46, it has like 200 residents.
That's good herb, by the way.
Is it? Well, that little town is now called San Francisco. And it has, you know, at that in like 1852, 6 years later, there's 36,000 people there. So like it's the port where everyone comes in to then try to go get gold. So traveling, you know, people came from all over the world. About half of them came from the U.S., most like the East Coast. And to get there, I don't know if you realize at that time, was like a huge ordeal. There was no easy way to get from the East Coast to the West Coast or vice versa. You had to sail down around the tip of South America, and it took 5 or 6 months for you to get from one place to the other. Now, there was a shortcut where you could go and sail down to Panama and then ride like a mule for like a week and a half through the jungle and then take another sail, steamer up to California. But it's incredibly difficult to get here. And what's even more amazing is all these supply ships that are coming to San Francisco, the guys who are the crew end up just like leaving the ship. Like they can't ever sail them. They just like, they're basically shipwrecked at that point because they all go looking for gold. And so there's a bunch of stuff that supposedly might've been built out of these old ships in San Francisco. It's like, there's supposed to be a restaurant that was built from a ship that like got crashed because no one was using it anymore. Anyway, so here's another interesting little tidbit. There's so many men involved here, right? Like lots of men and not very many women. And they end up doing like the social mores, given what they are, the freedom of it. There's a lot of cross-dressing actually that happens. And the men would then some men would wear a handkerchief at these dances to be the woman in this kind of social interaction. And there's some theories that think that, kind of the social fluidity of San Francisco and its queer history and heritage might've come from that initial, kind of relaxation of social mores. So people are panning for gold and you can find it relatively easily, but soon that's all gone, right? So now they have to, like, the technology has to advance and you have to get more invasive to actually get the gold out of the mountain. So it actually kind of goes corporate, like you need capital formation, and they start placer mining and hydraulic mining. So, which is basically just like shooting a fire hose at the mountainside and washing it away, eroding it. And then capturing the runoff and like filtering through it to get the gold nuggets out. Well, you know, unfortunately also a bunch of heavy metals are released into the environment when you do that. And there are still parts of the Sacramento Valley that like won't grow plant life because of the runoff from all this like hydraulic mining.
What is it? Mercury or what do you find in it?
I think it's mostly mercury, but I don't know what other So for basically from that time until now, there's been about 3,700 tons of gold taken out of the mountains, which is about 2% of the 187,000 that have been produced, like basically from the beginning of time. Now, like, how did this, like, what was the average experience economically of people who were making this huge move, right? About half of them made like sort of a modest profit, not really much to write home about. But most of the late arrivals were completely wiped out, right? Like all the gold's gone, everything's expensive. Most of the merchants eventually end up failing too, the ones who popped up to service this population. And save for a few like notable exceptions, like Levi Strauss, who created denim overalls that were very popular. And so Levi's is still a brand today. Now there's some interesting social implications that came from this kind of gold rush mentality. And it really gave birth to the California dream, which, you know, before that, the old American dream was sort of a Puritan's version, you know, Benjamin Franklin, get a little wealthier every day type of mentality. Well, now it's like you get rich quick, and it's usually some combination of audacity and good luck that come together to get you, you know, super rich overnight. And we saw that in agriculture in California at later periods, oil drillers like Getty. You had, you know, obviously like Hollywood and movie making and like people coming to be actors and actresses and wanting to get rich overnight and famous, airplane manufacturing, and then, you know, computers and chip manufacturers and Silicon Valley. And, you know, when you look at it and like, you know, .com, obviously, like that dream, that California dream is like, it's kind of been unicorns all the way down since then. And so it's kind of interesting. So let's maybe tease out then sort of some interesting things to today, which I think sort of relate to actually cryptocurrencies, which might be kind of a similar modern day gold rush. Whereas, you know, it's a get rich quick kind of dream that everyone is on. I tend to think that the majority of them will probably not get rich quick. I think it's also sort of shows it can be a distraction from the real like creation of economic value of goods and services for people, right? Because, you know, just like gold, them finding gold in the river didn't create goods and services. Neither does Bitcoin create goods and services necessarily. It's just a means of transacting, right? And interesting enough, the actual Sutter's Mill, the one that was built, the miners came and they tore it down because they needed the wood to like make little shanties and burn it to stay warm. So we took productive capacity of like, hey, we need a lumber mill to create things. And we went kind of a step backwards in advancement, which kind of gets a call back to one of the segments we had quite a while ago on Eugene von Braun-Ballwerk's work on the marginal utility of like grains of sack. I don't know if you guys remember that one.
Yeah.
So we took a lumber mill that could produce lumber and like we had to burn it to stay warm, basically. So that people could go looking for little shiny bits of metal in the river. And then the last thing is like, you know, maybe both of them have kind of trashed the environment in ways that's kind of an eerie parallel. So I have one more discussion point, but anything you guys want to talk about from the last, like, you know, 10 minutes of me rambling?
Goob is saying, listen to Bill and Preston podcast and then see how you're wrong, Jake. So Bill, you better give us the summary.
I never said anything about anything. I understand it's a comment. I understand. I am not the arbiter of Bitcoin truth. I think Preston has a very articulate and thought out answer. And people should listen to Preston for Preston's opinion. I do not know anything about Bitcoin for real.
You can't summarize what he said.
It's hard to summarize 2 hours of really thoughtful discussion in like a quip. I think if people are into it,
one tweet, go.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not like a hater or a lover of Bitcoin. That was a conversation I wanted to have because I think Preston's an interesting dude. You know, for me, I view sort of Bitcoin as the similar idea of basically, you know, just like short fiat or short some currency that it's priced in. And I sort of understand the elegance of the math. And, you know, I don't have like many deeper thoughts than that. I wish I had like this great answer, but I mean, look, if you don't like dollars, I don't mind a system that was created to allow people to keep their wealth in a mathematical formula. If that's what they want to do, then that's fine. If it all goes away, though, like, you know, that wouldn't shock me. If it explodes higher, that wouldn't shock me either. Like, I don't know.
Doesn't sound like a lot of storing of wealth if you have these really large bookends on where it's going to go.
Well, I think Preston would say that you don't. And like, I just haven't done the work to have an informed conversation about it. I know that it's incredible for ratings. And if I truly ran a media company, I would talk about it nonstop. Outside of that, I have no strong opinion.
That's fair. So I'll go ahead, Toby.
I was just going to say that the parallels between gold and Bitcoin, I think, are fairly similar in that it is like it's gold getting pulled out of the ground is a fairly useless activity because it's not, we don't use it for anything, which is one of the reasons why it's a good currency, because it's not consumed like silver, which is used in lots of technical applications.
Can I just say one thing real quick? Somebody says like in the comments, like it's used for criminal activities, makes it immoral for me. Then don't use cash either. Yeah. Like that I don't buy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true. That's true of anything that's a unit of exchange, right? It's going to be used for good things and for bad things. You can't hang it for that.
Yeah. And like, I don't know, Dalio buying it. Like, I don't know. Like when somebody says something like that, like, what does it even mean? What percentage of Dalio's net worth? How much marketing dollars did he get out of buying it? Like, I don't put any meaning in reading that somebody bought it.
Agreed.
But it's just another currency, right? From my perspective, like I'd say it is a currency if you don't like the way that the dollar is being treated by the Fed because they're pumping so much money out. Yeah, you can get out of it and you can get into Bitcoin or one of the other Ethereum or one of the other shit coins, whatever you want to do. I just don't have a view. I don't know how you know where it's going to go. And if I don't know where it's going to go, it's hard to kind of invest in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is sort of like some of these, it's not, but it's sort of like some of these tech valuations where people are just like, well, it doesn't really matter what happens between now and the next 5 years. In 5 years, they're going to be higher. You know, I guess if you structurally think the dollar is destined to go down forever, then Bitcoin could be the store of wealth, I guess, right? But like, I don't know.
But can't you achieve the same thing by using, you know, you buy shares in a company, aren't you achieving the same thing?
Yeah, my answer is I buy Charter, which the Bitcoin miner has to link on to their connection in order to mine it, and then I get the benefit of John Malone using leverage to charge people whatever currency of transaction there will be later, and then we use that currency to buy in shares. That's my answer. Do the same with Disney. Like, if y'all Bitcoin people get super rich, that's cool. I hope you spend all your money at Disney. Like, because, you know, park prices are going to go up and I'll take Bitcoin as well as fiat. Like, that's my answer. That's the only answer I know how to think of.
I like that answer.
There's an interesting phenomenon in the gold that you were discussing that we sort of we passed over that we should talk about. It's all that gold rush, in the sense that is the first half of people maybe made out moderately, covered their costs, made some money. Probably there were definitely groups of people in there who made a fortune, small group of people made a fortune. But then by the time the vast bulk of people come into it, and you can see this in any fund that does really well, the cash on cash returns tend to be bad. I read about this in Quantitative Value, but it's not his fault, but the CGN Focus Fund, Ken Huebner's fund, for that period of time, that was a decade, and at the end of the decade, he was Morningstar Manager of the Year, and he had compounded at an 18% CAGR over that full decade. The average investor in his funds lost 11% compound over that full period as well, because they rush in when it's high and then rush back out again when it's low, you know, doing the opposite of what you should be doing. It's just true of any phenomenon, right? Where there's a gold rush, the people who show up late, they all lose money on it. And if you can't see the parallel to Bitcoin, then I don't know what to tell you.
Well, I guess that this is what I would say in defense of it. You know, the idea that it's late innings, I think you can still make an argument that it's early innings. But I say this as someone that doesn't own it and isn't comfortable owning it. So,
you
like,
know anybody who doesn't own it or know what it is?
I mean, I don't own it, and I still don't really think I know what it is. I guess I just have a hesitation to have a strong opinion on it, because what I will tell you about the conversation with Preston is that guy's done a ton of work on it. Now, you know, does that mean he's right? No, but I wouldn't call like his thesis easily dismissible by somebody that's done the amount of work that I have. And that's the only opinion that I really will continue to articulate.
So if it has this price that it has to get to into the future, like why doesn't it just go to that price in the interim?
I mean, I guess because you got to discount what that price is going to be in some sort of interest rate, right? Some interest discount rate.
1.7%.
Yeah, I don't know.
All right, last piece of kind of...
I should just say something like highly inflammatory for ratings, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
Nah, we're already doing it.
Yeah. So this whole idea of the speed of information and how it traveled then, and I mean, taking 5 months to get from one coast to the other, you know, now if Elon has a thought that pops into his head, within 10 seconds, it can be in 50 million other people's heads like that. And the R naught of virality of information right now is gotten so extreme that I don't know exactly. I'm not sure we know what all the repercussions are of that. But it's kind of one thing I've been thinking about is like, maybe we just have like booms and busts that play out just really fast. And you just have to be really agile right now, because things will go crazy and then they'll disappear and then it'll be the next thing. And maybe like the speed of the cycles is picking up because of this virality coefficient.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. That's one of the when I was reading about Commodore Vanderbilt, who put in the Commodore, that's a very grand name for him. He was Cornelius Vanderbilt, Commodore by virtue of the fact that he had a whole lot of ships. He was involved in the creation of the Panama Canal and did that trip down where you had to be dragged across the rocks on donkeys, and then, or you could carry your boat over. There's a variety of different ways you could do it. And they had the paddle steamers that came.
Unpleasant.
Yeah, unpleasant. That's right. And you died of like dysentery. You died of, you know, mosquito bites. There were lots of different things that could kill you on the way through. And they had, you know, the invention of the steam paddle steamer accelerated all of those trips. You could get from the east coast of the US to England in a reasonably short period of time. But that was still, there was no telegraph until 1841. So that was how fast information went. So you could be arbitrage. You could do gold arbitrage by trading in one place and buying in one place and selling in another. But the arbitrage took months to play out. Whereas now it's, you know, it's faster.
That's why there's less money in it. Or, I mean, plus the competition, right?
I mean, but the HFT there's goes, less risk in it. Okay.
Yeah, harder to make money arbitraging something over months than a couple seconds.
My heart's not breaking for the HFT guys. I think they're doing okay.
Yeah.
They're going to be all right.
It's true.
Thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, good topic, JT. I guess it's mine. So I've just observed. So we had a good little value rally from whenever you want to pin it, September, November last year, and it ran through until about a month ago. And so since, for the last month, there's been a recovery in the techie type names, like ARK has bottomed out at 109 about maybe a month ago. Maybe it's a little bit less than that. And it's had a pretty solid rally here. Tesla too. I just, and as a result, I've noticed that all of the value stuff's kind of been sucking wind for a month. I don't have a view on whether that's necessarily the end of the value rally, although based on our experience over the last 5 years, you know, there's some evidence that might be the case. Once you get a 3 month rally in value, it's all over and then it goes backwards. But there's also the experience in 99, 2000 and through to 2002 was that there were many, many rallies in the techier, growthier stuff that then ultimately turned around and turned into busts. And so I'm just wondering if you guys have any view on where we are or what's happening.
I'll let Bill take this easy one.
I really don't.
Because one of the things...
I mean, I guess so. Here's the thing that's hard for me to understand. Like, I think that the market can get like way crazy, right? But a lot of these names, I think we've all been fairly consistent saying some of these names will be winners. We don't really know which ones. I don't think anybody has promised to be the person that can pick the one. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't be on a podcast doing this shit. We'd probably just be on the beach.
What hasn't happened yet?
What? That we've made it to the beach? This is the
winner,
problem.
The winner hasn't come in yet.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. So I guess what I was going to say is, like, you know, there's a lot of names that are down like 50%. I mean, could they go down 90? Yeah. Could they go down 75? Right. What's the old joke about a stock that's down 90 was down 80 and then halved. So, you know, but I don't know. I've never really bought the inflation comments. I've always kind of thought it's transitory. I think if that passes, people are going to buy long duration assets. These things are probably going to resume growth as the sales forces can get, like, not sales forces in the ticker, but like as the sales people can get it back out on the road. I don't know. I don't see why it should stop. I just don't know where else the money flows to. Some like growth is so scarce that if you've got an asset that's grown 50, 60% with 85% gross margins, I think you can tell yourself any story you want.
The only point that I was going to make is that the successful tech companies like Google, Microsoft, you know, Facebook, probably throw that in there. The FANGs, FAMGs, they're already sort of, I was going to say they're already pretty mature, but then they are growing at very high rates still. But I regard those, they're almost sort of more in the value bucket these days. That they're not super, super expensive. They're sort of trading on fundamentals more than anything else, right? Is that fair?
What are?
Microsoft, Amazon.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I think they're closer to value than anything.
Yeah. And that, but they're not really caught up in the wreck. I mean, if you look at the way they've traded recently, I mean, the complaint last year was that Google hadn't done anything for a while.
Yeah, that's right. And like, even I don't know when I like said that Tyler was like arguably value or something, but that's like pretty much flat despite, you know, I mean, it had a run and now it's down. I don't know. Like, I think shit just got a little nuts. Like, you know, I think for a bit when you hear Fastly pitched as a software company and it's a CDN, which requires CapEx, like it just got a little nutty in certain areas. But a lot of those SPACs things have sold off. Yeah, that's right. Like, so, yeah, that SPAC bubble and stuff. But
A SPAC is a rare creature, right? A SPAC is like the market is so hungry for equity that people are prepared to just take their equity back by cash and a promise to do something. So basically you're just exchanging your dollars for 80 cents on the dollar with the chance that there's going to be some pop that they're going
to
do some
acquisition. With a lotto ticket stapled to it.
Yeah. And you're like, that's, you know, that's good enough for me. With the idea that as soon as they announce the deal, it's going to, you know, 10 bag or something like that. Like that kind of behavior, that's really, I think that's super speculative behavior that you really only see right at the tail end of a bull market. So I would have thought that was one of the indicia of the late stage bull, dying bull.
Yeah, I guess it depends what SPAC, right? I mean, if you're buying like a SPAC that has $10 in trust for $10, then I don't think that that's crazy. If you're paying 16,
right,
you got some air under it. And if you're hoping that somebody, you know, SPACs some space company and you're paying a 60% premium to trust, then not a game I'm comfortable with.
But even in the ordinary course, like you wouldn't go and swap, you know, people would, but you wouldn't, right? You wouldn't go and you're not going to do the SPAC deal before you kind of see what they're going to do, would you?
I own one.
That's a good point.
But it's trading below trust and the warrants are going to separate in 45 days or 40 days. So if I get free warrants and I can sell it close to trust, then I just picked up free warrants. And if I can't, then I get to put it back to the SPAC sponsor.
So
and
it's
earn
an
some
op.
Interest. Yeah. So I don't think that's like super speculative behavior. It's
no,
just like,
fair.
What the fuck am I going to do with cash? Sit there and collect 50 basis points. And if it's close to trust, I think I should be able to liquidate it for pretty close to trust. So
yes.
I'm just trying to harvest warrants.
So you thought, yeah. So your downside is like nothing, and you've got some warrant kickers if it works.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I think about it. I'm just trying to like collect warrants in that particular situation.
I'm just trying to work out what inning we're in.
I don't know, man.
Phil, that's the fun part. Scorekeeper.
I don't know. I think we might get ready for another run here in some of the crazy stuff, but what do I know?
If you have some questions, throw them in, guys. We'll chat about them. Now I saw some.
We'll ignore them.
Here's the tough thing about tech, like and tech investment, right? Like I saw somebody in the comment mention Biden's tax plan. Like these guys aren't going to pay much taxes. They don't run at profits. Like taxes actually hurt mature cash flowing businesses more than these growthy names. So if you were long the growthy names and then taxes came out, I'd even argue that that's more of a reason to get long, because you're just further deferring your tax expense.
Or you're in Dublin or.
Yeah. It's weird. I don't know. Like it's like any scenario that you can tell me other than valuation compression, like I could argue tech wins. So that's kind of why I think a lot of people just keep buying it until they won't.
If you have an income stream that's, you know, very material, it's like a public company, big enough to be a public company kind of income stream, and you can convert that into a company that you then sell a portion of it to the public. And so you get your money, you're just converting your income into capital gains in that instance, right? And it makes complete sense to do it because the long-term capital gains rate is so much lower than your marginal income tax rate. But if that gets changed, which I don't know exactly what the tax proposal is, but isn't there some talk about increasing the capital gains tax rate or getting rid of the long-term rate?
Yeah, probably. I don't know about getting rid of it, but increasing the capital gains, certainly for people, I think, that make over $1 million or something.
Do you think that the carried interest will skate through again?
Yes.
Too many rich people like that.
Yeah, 100%.
I just sort of wonder, like, what if that
democracy
has some impact.
Well, I mean, like, part of me is like, okay, so let's say that the tax rates go up on capital gains. So to me, the incentive is to further avoid things like re-ratings, because then you're playing a re-rating game. Then you have to sell the re-rating. Then you have to pay more tax. So then I'm saying, like, well, I guess I should just like buy an index, which can, you know, perpetually on a tax advantaged way, recycle itself, or some of these like more compounder type names that you don't have to sell for a long time. Like I don't know. I just, yeah. Taxes to me aren't like the thing that brings the house down.
Yeah.
At the margin though, it should change your behavior, shouldn't it?
Well, I guess that's what I'm saying. Like I would actually argue that maybe it would push me into like riskier behavior at the margin. Are more long duration assets, which is kind of nuts, right?
Powell wins.
What?
I said Powell wins.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that's not Powell, right? That's the government. Yeah.
We didn't talk about Burry's Tesla puts. Do you guys have anything interesting to add there?
No, it's not a stock I'm worth listening to.
I don't. Like those are all notional values that are get quoted anyway. I'd want to know what the real underlying amount was, and it's probably some tiny portion of his portfolio. So that's kind of a non headline to me, but whatever.
There's somebody says he's getting into shipping. I haven't followed his. I don't follow his 13S that closely, honestly.
Burry's getting into shipping? Oh,
yeah.
I didn't see that.
Is it late to the party to be getting into shipping? It sort of felt like shipping was huge last year, but it's. I mean, maybe it's when he got into it. I don't know.
I think the part of the shipping idea that I sort of understand is like these environmental standards that are coming down the pike, potentially like restricting the amount of ships that could possibly be produced, and then you get into the structural shortage. I could see that.
What's been the issue with shipping over the last 12 months? It was sort of an issue before.
Well, they went nuts when oil went negative. Well, no, it went nuts when oil wasn't negative, right? And then they could like jack prices through the roof because there was no storage because oil kept getting pumped and nobody had any demand because the world shut down. That was a little bit too like complicated for me to figure out. I think the historical problem with shipping is it doesn't generate any cash and a bunch of schmucks have run the companies.
Yeah, I think you want to own the steel rather than the equity. That's what I've been told by folks in that business.
It seems like an incredible business to lend to.
But it seems like it's a pretty good growth. Like, in terms of secular growth, shipping's got to be, we're just going to be sending more and more stuff around the world over time, right? So it's got to be a pretty good.
I don't know.
Whereas,
man,
the problem that the supply is so constant that you don't really ever make any money out of it.
I mean, I could kind of argue that supply chains get more localized and, you know, train freight or something is the beneficiary over time.
Did you mean goods or armies being sent?
Yeah, I don't know. Shipping's hard to me, but it could work. Right, Cuppy did a lot of work on it, right? People seem to like to cite him, so that's where I'll direct people to. That's how the echo chamber works.
Yeah. Well, there's the definitive answer. It's on Twitter.
Yeah. That was on one name I asked for feedback, and like a couple people gave me feedback, and it all came back to the same guy. I was like, okay, these are not varying opinions. It's just one guy.
That's how it all works.
Patient zero.
You got to track it back to patient zero. Yeah,
that's right.
PayPal added a new customer every single second last quarter. Lower regulatory risk than any big tech. Any thoughts on the stock?
Nope. Next.
Nope.
JT?
I don't know enough to have an opinion at this point. I mean,
yeah, neither do I. A few people have been talking about it, though. It's all that stuff is always going to be a little bit expensive looking to me, but I can see how it's a great business. I bet that eBay's kicking themselves that they got rid of it. Probably wish they'd gone with PayPal.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd ask Elliot Turner. I go again, your $305 billion business. So let's see what JP Morgan is. Not that they're the same business. I get they're not the same business. So it's 35/50 of JP Morgan. Do that math, 70%, right? I don't know. Maybe it could work.
What do you think about Buffett tipping out of Wells Fargo completely and Chevron like dumping half the stake?
I mean, I said he was wrong when he did it. And that was 70% ago. I think he's been wrong on that. I don't think he and Charlie held Wells. I don't think Buffett's right on Wells. There's something in his mind, I think, that fundamentally misassessed that situation, including when he held it and it was clearly run like a shit house and he defended them.
It's funny, right? Because I didn't realize it had such a long association with it. It's since 75 or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, this is not the question for me. It's the question for what's his name? Mead, the guy that was on
Adam
your
Mead. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a question for him, but I think Buffett has had good success with banks when he bought them and they could grow, right? Like when you think about the Wells that he bought in 1975, there were a lot of locations that they could still open up. It was a constant strategy. Didn't have a lot of disruption risk.
I thought he bought most of it in like early 90s after California real estate crack up.
No, that's right. That's right.
Probably right. I was guessing 75.
But like, I mean, M&T Bank, what else has he owned? US Bank, like I don't know.
Solomon.
I
think
that wasn't a great one. so I don't know. I just think I think the problem with Wells is it's big and it's hard to see how they're going to continue to grow other than like they could grow on a per share basis by eating themselves, but they're North American focused. So like, how are they going to continue to grow when they should arguably take in branches? I don't know. I think that's probably what he was thinking, but
I just think it's, you know, he never sells. Very, very rarely sells. It's grown pretty substantially. So there's a pretty big tax hit. I mean, that's about as loud as he ever speaks on anything if he just ships it like that.
Yeah, well, he was wrong.
But you don't know what he's got other considerations besides just what the stock's going to do, right?
I don't think we need to defend him on this. Like, he was wrong.
I'm just interested to know.
I'm just telling you what I think. I've thought it for a long time. Like, I think he defended a previous management team that when I read that House report from the Republicans on Wells Fargo. It was shocking how bad that bank was run. And he defended them the whole time. And then Scharf came in, and I think something in his head was like, well, this guy doesn't want to even live in San Fran, so I don't trust this guy or something. And meanwhile, Moynihan did the exact same thing at Bank of America. And now Moynihan is like some genius that everybody wants to be, you know, be associated with. Something's wrong. Maybe it's because he thought that the culture is rotten to the core, but why he thinks it now and he didn't think it 3 years ago is just very, very hard for me to understand, because that's when the culture was actually rotten. And now that all of management is turned over and the entire board is turned over, he finally sells. Like, that doesn't make sense to me. When, by the way, it was like $130 billion on $15 billion normalized. Like, that, I don't know. I don't get it. Never have.
All right. On that note, folks, that's it. We'll see you next week. Move with the rhythm. Shake it up, stop when the clock hits 13.